Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations podcast. Today is Friday, at long last. It is the 16th of October. This is 2020. I'm your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, don't call it a comeback. He's been here for years. Andrew Orr. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Kelly. I am looking forward to just relaxing completely this weekend. There's a ton of Apple news and, you know, I've been on the show every day this week, so yeah. We all know what's going on.
Yeah, you're looking forward to just being silent, I think, for 2 days in a row is probably really what it is.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad you're here because, as I said at the top of the show, it is Friday, and that means Security Friday. So we, as per tradition, you know, of this year, we're going to start with some basic news, some news from around the web. Other stuff did happen this week, aside from new phones. And we have some news that's a regular, we have some news about a regular topic on Security Friday, but it's good news this time.
Yeah, so I think we've mentioned Zoom a couple times. At one point, not only did they inserted some weird thing into their app, and Apple had to issue an update to remove it in the Mac app.
Yeah, you have to. They secretly installed a web server, so you wouldn't have to click OK. I think was what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, but then they acted like they were kind of surprised people were complaining about it or something like that.
Yeah, we don't understand why everybody's mad. We did this thing completely without telling anybody. So
anyway, they are going to be doing something good. Starting next week, they are going to be adding end-to-end encryption for their video calls. Woohoo! And the quote that I shared just says, as you know, as end-to-end encryption works, we're going to be using public key cryptography, so the keys are going to be generated on each person's device and mm-hmm. not accessible by us. So, right. Thumbs up.
Yeah, this is great news. It's something a lot of people have been worried about with Zoom is who can get it, the data from there, and you know, there were some issues I think with server locations and things. So they've had a lot of stuff that kind of didn't look good for them, and this is a thing that looks good for everybody using Zoom, which last I checked was everybody. So it's really nice that they're stepping that up.
Yeah, and something that I forgot about, but Dave had mentioned earlier, when we're using Zoom calls, they do have at the top, it says it uses enhanced encryption, which I don't know what that means because it's not end-to-end encryption, so maybe that's kind of misleading.
It is. I wonder if they mean enhanced encryption the way my phone keeps telling me I have 5G. So... I'm not entirely
exactly.
By the way, for those playing along at home, I don't have 5G. just so we're clear, I just have AT&T, and it's said 5G forever. So anyway,
you have 5GE.
I have 5GE. Yeah, which I don't know what that means either, and I still don't know how they get away with it. But that's a story for another day, because we have another story to talk about here, which is that Barnes & Noble. Remember Barnes & Noble? Barnes & Noble had a data breach over the weekend. This week in data breaches, because we always get here, it seems.
Yeah, we've had a lot of these.
It's like a subsection of Security Friday. This week in data breaches, yeah.
So this data breach by, as Kelly said, Barnes & Noble, this happened on Saturday, October 10th, and they've been emailing customers recently to tell them what happened. And let me quickly find who I did this. Okay, so this is by Tripwire.com. And Tripwire, it sounds like it may be part of a bigger hacking campaign. Mm-hmm. They mentioned that maybe Barnes & Noble was using Pulse Secure VPN. We may have talked about that on the show or not. I don't remember, but...
I don't either. It doesn't sound too familiar. So, yeah.
But, yeah, it's maybe, you know, Barnes & Noble is just the latest attack in this series.
Yeah.
And so they said that some of the data that was accessible by these hackers included email addresses, billing and shipping addresses, and telephone numbers. Ooh. However, the silver lining is that, thankfully, financial data like credit card numbers was actually encrypted. So
that is
safe from these people.
Well, that's good news. At least that information was secured. So I'm sorry Barnes & Noble got hacked, but good on them for actually caring about people's actual relevant information. Mm-hmm. So, and I say that because in the grand scheme of things, getting somebody's name and address isn't really all that complicated of a process. If you were to go seek it out about somebody, getting that part usually isn't that hard. But getting the credit card information should be more difficult, and in this case it was, and so I'm glad about that. So that's good news, at least for Barnes & Noble people. And that's that also includes people who have a Nook, right? Is it the Nook that's the Barnes & Noble e-reader?
Yes. So the quote that was shared says, the firm said it was working urgently to get all Nook services back to operation. Okay. Because people were saying and complaining that they weren't able to download books that they had purchased on their Nook ebook readers.
So yeah, you can't
it
have that.
Sounds like it may have affected all their systems.
Yeah, probably. Interesting. So I hope that's better for everybody that has a Nook. That would be very good news. Now, our other news bit today is something that's interesting to me because it's about the way that, in this case, Homeland Security is going about warrants.
Yes. So this story is from the Register, and we'll lead up to the story first. So it's a whole thing. So
yes,
they write, in June, there was a rented SUV that was set on fire outside the home of a witness involved in the ongoing U.S. prosecution of R. Kelly.
Okay.
And then in August, it says Homeland Security agents found this guy called Michael Williams. They accused him of setting fire to this vehicle. They charged him with attempting to use intimidation and threats. And then it wasn't until this week that we got a little bit more information on how they found this person. Mm-hmm. And it was because Google. So they sent what is called a geofence warrant to Google, which means, hey, Google, give us all the IP addresses of people who searched for the address of the home that this vehicle was at. They were able to suss through all that data and they found this guy. And that does sound kind of cool that, you know, yay law enforcement, even though we do write about privacy and security, but we do root for law enforcement. So this is cool that they were able to do that. But it is kind of nerve-wracking because it involved a dragnet of all these different people. So even if you search for some address and you weren't involved with a crime at all, well, along down the road, if the address is used in a crime, then your address could be involved in the search warrant. And so you may get a call from law enforcement asking you, why did you search this address? Mm-hmm. And you could be completely innocent.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. And as we talked about this before to see if it was something we wanted to have on the show, that's a thing that I wonder about because I know that I have looked up some things that, without context, seem like it could be something that might get the attention of law enforcement if law enforcement's cruising through my search history. Even if it's for a completely innocuous reason, a completely benevolent thing. I'm just curious about how this particular whatever works and go look it up to go learn a thing. Not because like I'm looking up explosive because I want to go try and make explosives or anything like that, but something that, you know, like, oh, I've looked that up or I've looked up this sort of thing, you know, to find something out. And then trust me, nobody wants anybody scraping through their search history. This is just the known across all internet users is nobody wants anyone to delete their search history. In fact, it goes so far as I know people who have said, you know, make sure you have a will. Make sure if you have an end of life directive that you have that filled out. Make sure you have power of attorney and make sure that you know someone who has your computer password so they can go delete your search history. These are the things that you need in case you are suddenly taken. So it's important. So we don't want people going through it. The thing that was interesting to me about this as a legal tactic, basically, is that they knew they were going after somebody, but they didn't know who, and cast this net really wide in order to see if they could get something. So when I think of warrants, I think of the law enforcement goes to a location, and it's usually pretty narrow in scope. It's either like the technology that you have access to in your home, or we only want the hard drives we know live in this particular room of the house, things like that. Like, however warrants work. Hi, John, because I'm sure John Keat is shouting right now because I don't quite understand it as well as I maybe need to, particularly living
attorney
here.
At large, John X. Keat.
Yes, attorney at large, John X. Keat. hi, John. So when I think about this, like, they're usually going after a person, and we want stuff related, you know, that this person has access to so that we can get the evidence, because we're looking for the evidence we need to prove they did the thing. And this isn't about a person. Like, this particular warrant is, we just want Google to give us everybody in this area who searched for, I think, was it search for explosives? Like, aside from the address, like, somebody who also searched for explosives or something like that, I think.
Yeah, something like that. Like, there is more to the story, which is pretty interesting, because they ended up sending a warrant to Verizon, too.
Yeah. So, this is the thing that, like, because it's possible for this to have been a very vague thing, you know, that they cast a really wide net for, that's the part that I thought was sort of concerning. And then the other piece of, particularly in this article, the thing that stood out to me was these data, this is a quote from Google, these data demands represent less than 1% of total warrants and a small fraction of the overall legal demands for user data that we currently receive. Because that sentence just gives me like 96 more questions, honestly.
And it's a complete non-answer, because when you're talking about numbers like that, Google is so big, they receive billions of searches every day.
Yeah.
So less than 1% could still be a couple hundred million people.
Right. But also, what are that other 99 point whatever percent of warrants that you're getting? And if this is a small fraction of overall legal demands, what are your overall legal demands? Like, why can't you? Tell me about that. Like, that's that's a lot more interesting to me all of a sudden than the concerning thing they did so that law enforcement could find this one dude. It seems like this could go down a really not great path. Particularly, let's say, for example, you happen to be a person who lives in an anarchist jurisdiction. You know, maybe the police are way more interested in my search history than in Andrew's, for example. That could be not great. So that's part of why we wanted to talk about it, is because I haven't seen a whole lot of other information about these sort of geofence warrants, which is just show us everybody here that searched for this thing, and not, you know, and not so much about just give me the search history for this person that we already, you know, like, for whatever this thing is that we're doing. So,
yeah. Well, I could still be another example. Like, I'm the one who writes about privacy and security at the Mag Observer.
That's true.
I write, like, how to use a Tor browser, which VPN you can use. I can tell you which DNS server claims to block NSA and FBI servers. So that is definitely suspicious.
Apparently I'm going to need that article later. Because I've just talked myself into, like, maybe I need a Tor browser and a VPN, living out here anyway. It feels like this sort of warrant could end up being used sort of against people. Like, I don't want to see warrants getting weaponized, and that kind of sounds like where this could be headed. So again, right now we don't have anything to really do except report on it to you and share with you that this is a warrant, a sort of warrant that is happening now that we should all be aware of. Because again, security, most of Security Friday is awareness. And so there you have it. Now, I know, Andrew, you've been on all week talking to me about new stuff. We've talked about new iPhones. We've talked about the new cameras and the new iPhones. We've talked about all those kinds of things. And so because pre-orders started today for the iPhone 12 and the iPhone 12 Pro, we thought it would be good to talk about backing up your information, partly because if you are a person who's ordered a new device today, or if you're ordering one in 2 weeks, making sure that that data transfer happens as smooth as possible is pretty important.
Yeah, so something we were talking about when you're setting up a new iPhone, especially if you have, if you already have an iPhone, and it's called Quick Start. Mm-hmm. So when you're going through the process on the new phone, at some point in the setup process, you'll see like this swirly picture of dots that are just like, it's really cool to look at. It's just a lot like swirl.
If you have an Apple Watch, it's the same setup, the same sort of process as the Apple Watch, where the Apple Watch will have this sort of 3D array of dots on the screen. And you take a you hold your camera over the watch. Like if you go through the pairing on your, in the watch app on your phone, then it'll go, okay, now take a picture of the screen on the Apple Watch. And so you you hold your phone over it, and then that's how it negotiates the pairing. And then that's how your phone gets tied to your watch and how they have a relationship now. It's really nifty. And they've ported that, I guess, so that you can do the same thing from your old phone to your new phone.
Yeah. So, yeah, so it involves the iPhone camera. And like we were talking about with macOS setup a week or two ago, iOS setup will encourage you to use privacy settings. Like, do you want to turn location services on? Do you want to, I don't know, encrypt your iCloud backup using Siri? Like, do you want them to be able to save some of your recordings for their analytics?
Yeah.
And you'll have all these different options, which is great for people. So when you're going through the setup, just keep an eye out for those. And it's our opinion you should go with more private services, but just go with what you think is good for you.
Yeah.
I think that is maybe the best advice.
And the nice thing about each of those screens is that it gives you sort of an overview. You can go dig into, it says like learn more at the bottom, and it'll take you to like the long legalese description of everything. But you can sort of look at the sentence and it'll say, do you want to share crash information, you know, with developers? Do you want to share your Siri interactions so that she can be improved? Things like that. They do those sorts of things. And it's great that they do, because they tell you very clearly, like, here's what it means if you say on or off or whatever. And you can skip those things and set them up later, too. The thing that I would point out, because what I don't remember with Quick Start is how much stuff gets transferred from device to device. And the reason I'm wanting to make sure that we talk about that is because there are certain things you can do to make sure that a lot of data gets preserved. And that is kick it old school. I guess we'd call that Flashback Friday, right? Isn't that what that used to be? And let's talk about backing your computer up to your Mac. Yes, I said back your computer up to your Mac, because your phone is a computer. Like, yeah, for real. So take your phone, plug the cable into the side of your computer, you know, your Mac, your iMac, your MacBook Pro, what have you. Plug it in, and if you're not using Catalina, then you'll be using iTunes to do the backup. And if you use Catalina, your phone will show up in the sidebar like an external drive that you've connected, like a thumb drive or an external hard drive. And you click on it there, and you can tell it to backup. And then you can tell it to backup using encryption. And you can use encrypted backups to store a bunch of data that otherwise would not be preserved. And that would be all of your saved passwords. At least you don't have to enter them again. All of your Wi-Fi settings, your search history. We're just going to talk about that all day today, apparently. your call history and your health data. So health data is a big piece of that, and making sure that all of those things, you know, if you've got like a streak going, that you don't lose your streak. So your backups to your computer are not encrypted by default, so you'll have to turn that on. It's a separate option that you can use, but then you can backup everything locally to your computer, particularly if you're in a place where Wi-Fi maybe isn't great, or your cellular connection isn't fantastic. Sometimes restoring from an iCloud backup would take a lot longer than just plugging your old phone into your computer and then plugging in your new phone, and your new phone will go, "Hi, I'm new. Do you want me to set this up as a brand new phone, or do you want to use a backup? And here's a list of the backups you have on your computer. Here you go. Which one do you want?"
Yeah. And
so it's very handy.
Some of this encryption does work with iCloud backup too. The most important thing, and this is what you'll see probably, I think it's been a while since I've set up a new phone, but you'll probably be encouraged to use two-factor authentication with your Apple ID. And this is the thing that makes sure that your data is encrypted. Encrypted. So it's encrypted in transit and on the server.
Yes.
But on Apple's iCloud security overview, there is only a small subsection of data that is actually truly end-to-end encrypted. And like Kelly said, this involves your Apple Card transactions, home data, health data, iCloud keychain, something like Memoji. Like, that sounds kind of innocuous, but Memoji, and also the words that your keyboard learns as part of
its word
vocabulary, that is encrypted. Screen time, Siri information, and also your W1 and H1 Bluetooth keys.
Okay.
So, and of course, that will also be, you know, encrypted when you back up to your Mac too.
Yeah.
So it's the same kind of concept here.
Yeah. So that's going to do it for us today. We do always like to have a practical tip for people on Security Friday. If you have an idea what that tip might be, if you just want to tell us how excited you are that you got a new phone and that it's shipping next Friday, whatever it is, we want to hear about it. So it doesn't matter what you want to tell us about. We always want to know. So you can get us at observations@macobserver.com, at TMO Daily on Twitter, or by leaving comments in the show notes. So that's going to do it for us today. Here are the last words Andrew's going to speak for the next 72 hours. Andrew, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and have a good weekend, everyone. I know I will.
A nice quiet weekend, I imagine. I'm your host, Kelly Gamon. I will talk to all of you again on Monday. In the meantime, be excellent to each other, and let's be careful out there.